My very special guest this evening is Roger Waters, founder, of course, of Pink Floyd, and with a very successful solo career after that band. He has now just finished his first full opera, a work he began work on, I believe, in 1989, Satira. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's been a while.
It's inspired by the story of hope and promise during the optimistic early days of the French Revolution and brought to life on the CD by the likes of Welsh bass baritone Bryn Terfel. I'm delighted that Roger's agreed to talk exclusively to Drive Time. Roger, welcome.
Thank you.
Chairman Mao famously said when someone asked him what he thought about the French Revolution that it was too early to say. Do you think it's a story and these are events that have some contemporary significance?
What a great wit he was.
I thought he was always
sadly
joking.
Sadly missed. A laugh a minute, Chairman Mao. Well, you know, I've been doing a number of these interviews and the thought has struck me from time to time that you could say that the political and economic situation in the early 1780s in France could be seen as a sort of microcosm of what's happening globally now, in that, you know, there it was the monarch was attached to a god, and then there was the nobility and the clergy, and they had all the power and all the money and all the stuff, and beneath them were the peasantry who had nothing. And that chillingly like the situation we have globally, where, you know, the Western civilized world's got all this stuff. And also some of us, not least George Bush and Tony Blair, feel themselves attached to a deity in a way that I don't understand. And then we have the third world that's not got a lot.
And have you, via your libretto, tried to, you know, inject contemporary significance?
Well, I didn't write the libretto. The libretto was written by Étienne Rodagil, who was a Frenchman, who's a friend of mine. Though I have to say, I've written an English version.
Which is more than a translation, isn't it?
It is more than a translation, yeah. I added to, having translated the work, I then added to it considerably and added some narrative. And I've now lost the thread of whatever it was you asked me.
Did you, via what the extra bits you put in, try and give any kind of contemporary gloss or relevance to the story?
Well, at a certain point, I suggest that we might abide by the Constitution. There's a lot of lip service paid in the Declaration of Independence from the revolution that preceded the French Revolution, which was the American War of Independence, where they talk about certain inalienable rights, that all men are created equal, and so on and so forth. And it's something that seems to have slipped quietly into the background, you know, in the way that they pursue their foreign policy, not to mention some of their domestic policy. So I think it bears examination.
Physically, literally, what was the genesis of the project? You said that you came to it in 1989.
Yeah, well, Etienne and his wife Nadine produced this beautiful document, which was 50 pages of illustrated libretto, and came and asked me if I would set it to music. Which I did at that point, and I made a demo working at home in London, and that demo then went to France, and François Mitterrand listened to it, and he lent his support and said it should be part of the bicentennial celebrations. We never achieved that at the time. I think it founded rather on French chauvinism. I mean, the idea of something being performed for in celebration of their revolution by some English bass player was stuck rather in the Gallic craw. But and then there were Nadine sadly died tragically soon afterwards, and then we shelved the project for a long time, but then I picked it up in the mid-90s, and I've sort of been working on it ever since.
Am I right in thinking that initially Etienne considered using Pink Floyd material?
No, what he did was he asked if he could use old tunes of mine, possibly in some way, which I thought was an odd idea, but I liked the work so much that I decided to try and produce new work.
In the early days of Pink Floyd, critics would routinely use words like classical in structure, because that's the thing rock critics did then. But have you always had an affinity for classical music?
I've always liked some classical music, yeah, and particularly choral work, and particularly work from the early 19th century. So that, you know, if you listen to this record, you'll find that it's rooted in a sort of romantic tradition from that time, rather than it's not like modern classical works, which are sometimes a bit intellectual for
squeaky
my taste.
Gate music.
But yeah. I always loved you know, French music as well. I was a big fan of Berlioz choral works and things like the Te Deum and the Requiem and stuff. So
When in recent years rock songwriters like Elvis Costello, Paul McCartney have entered the sphere of classical music, they've said that they've encountered a kind of sniffy prejudice from the establishment. Have you expected or encountered any of that?
Well, I haven't. It's too early yet, but I certainly expect it from certain quarters. But on the other hand, you know, people like Bryn have worked on it, have expressed a great enthusiasm for the work. It is very melodic and it's very emotional and it's unashamedly romantic in style. And hopefully it will be accessible not just to, punters, but to some of the classical establishment as well. I await, not with bated breath, but, you know, to see what they have to say.
Let's hear a little now. This is Marianne's selection from Sciera by Roger Waters, who's my guest on Drive Time tonight. Thinking back, people have referred to things like Dark Side of the Moon and The Wall as epic in scope, but you've actually been doing similar kinds of ventures, even as far back as Atom Heart Mother, weren't you? There's an extended suite on Atom Heart Mother.
There was, yeah.
So do you think you have a natural predisposition to bigger sort of structures like this?
Yeah, I think enough time has gone by now that we can assume that, you know, I'm not going to change tack, certainly at this point, yeah.
Yeah. What is it about that appeals to you?
I don't know. I seem to be interested in stories or ideas that, you know, take more than 3 or 4 minutes to express, and that, you know, that have a kind of a beginning and a middle and an end and some form and structure.
And you've said, I know, that you'd like to think that in the world of arena rock, you've introduced something of the world of theatre or opera to it.
Arena rock. Yeah, well, you know, back in the 70s when Pink Floyd kind of got popular and we moved out of 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 seat theatres or small arenas into larger arenas, it felt necessary to me to fill the space, which is why I started experimenting with, you know, big pigs and inflatables and projections and all sorts of other paraphernalia that, you know, hopefully made the experience more visceral.
Yeah. I, of course, would be neglecting my duty not to ask you about Live 8 and the reformation for that gig. And, well, how did it happen? If you don't mind telling the story again, how physically did you happen to end up on that stage?
It was great, I have to say, before I start on the story. It was just wonderful. I loved it, every minute of it. What happened, very briefly, Bob Geldof, I think he rang Dave up and said, will you do it, you know, put the band. And Dave said no, and then he went and saw him, and Dave said no again. And then I think Bob saw Nick at a party or was speaking to him, and I got an email from Nick Mason saying, I've had Geldof bending my ear about this Live 8 thing. Do you mind if I give him your number? I said, no, never mind. Give me his number. I'll ring him. So I rang him, and it was a fantastic conversation because he was just about to take Jean-Marie, you know, it was her birthday, and he was about to take her out for a birthday dinner. So I had this fabulous conversation that was sort of, well, you know, we've got to save the world. Yeah, try it with the green shoes, you know. And eventually said, I've got to go, I'm taking her out to dinner. He said, I'll call you. And so I said, all right. I said, you've got to tell me what you want me to do if I'm going to make the phone call. So a couple of weeks later, the phone rings, and it's Bob, and he says, will you call Dave? He said, I've written him a long letter, but Nick Mason says it's a waste of ink and Roger will have to call. So he said, will you? I said, of course I will. I haven't got his phone numbers, though. And he said, well, I've got his numbers. So I said, all right, I'll call him. And he gave me the number, and Dave answered the phone. And he was a bit surprised, I think, that it was me on the phone. He wasn't a bit surprised, he was very surprised. But we had a really good conversation, and he said, well, I'm not sure because of this and that and the other. And I said, well, he said, I'll think about it. And he did, and 24 hours later, he called back and he said, yeah, okay, let's do it.
It was a very emotional moment to watch. Was it emotional to be part of?
Oh, it was terrific. Yeah, I can't tell you. It was a sort of great weight off my back, really, to, you know, discover a rapprochement with the three guys after all this time and after all the enmity that's been widely publicised. It was terrific. And it was great to hear the songs played again. It was so easy. It was like, you know, putting on a pair of old shoes, really. It was great.
How did you choose the songs?
We had a meeting in the Connaught Hotel, and Dave and I sort of agreed that Wish You Were Here and Comfortably Numb sort of chose themselves, and then, you know, we had a bit of a conversation about what to open with. I wanted to open with In the Flesh, but he wanted to open with Breathe, so I thought I'd roll over, which I did. I mean, Breathe is such a beautiful song. And really, In the Flesh, if I'm honest, I sort of wanted to do that, partly because I have an attachment to the whole Marching Hammer thing and partly because I wanted to sing something. But anyway, I sang a bit of Wish You Were Here, and of course I sing Uncomfortably Numb. And then Money was a sort of afterthought, rather foisted on us partly by Geldof and partly by other people who said, you've got to do one of the hits, you know, and we didn't really want to do Brick 2, so Money was... Money seemed rather apposite to the occasion. And so I think it was, you know, I think it was a good set and we all agreed on.
I think by common consent it was the highlight of a great day, but there was something about, I think, the idea, and you must have felt this as well, that it was about overcoming some previous disagreements and enmity, as you say. It felt like it was in the spirit of the whole enterprise, wasn't it?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, I have, through my career and in my work and whatever, paid lip service to the idea that political leaders and all kinds of people ought to be able to come together and have dialogues in spite of differences of opinion. And it struck me increasingly over the last few years that it was rather hypocritical of me to espouse those values and yet still be not on speaking terms with Dave. And so it was a great opportunity to be able to get that monkey off my back and to grow up a bit, really.
And could we expect you to do it again?
I don't see why not. I mean... strangely enough, I went out to dinner with Nick last night, and who should wander into the restaurant but Dave? So we sat down and we had a drink or two. And he, funnily enough, he said that's the first time he's been in London since Live 8. So that was a weird coincidence. But I mean, if a similar situation arose where there was something that felt like right for us to do with some charity or some political event, I see no reason why we shouldn't reconvene at some point in the future. I think we all really enjoyed it.
And more pressingly, Sat-Era will be... What will its immediate future be in terms of performance?
Well, the record comes out on September the 26th or 27th, and we are doing a concert performance in Santa Cecilia Auditorium in Rome on November the 17th. That is not a production of the opera, but it's, it's the full 82-piece orchestra and a big mixed chorus and kids and 8 soloists. And so... And I've been prevailed upon by the promoter of the event and have agreed rather unwisely to conduct the overture of the piece. So I might have to go home in a minute and practice. But so that's happening. And hopefully there'll be some more concert performances in North America. Half a dozen apparently have been talked about to do in the spring next year.
Fabulous. Roger, thanks very much for coming on Drive Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.